Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show is a great guest, Greg Furman. Greg is a journalist and historian who spent 5 years writing and researching the topic of today's discussion. His new book called This Vast Enterprise. His first book was Author in Chief, but described by Thomas Mallon of the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books on the American presidency to appear in recent years. Furman lives in Indiana with his wife and children, and it's good to talk to a Midwesterner. So, Greg, thanks for reaching out and striking up a conversation about your new book. This is great.
Hey, I'm always ready to talk Lewis and Clark, but especially with Midwesterners.
Good. What drew you to write on this subject of all the things you could write about?
My first book, Author in Chief, you mentioned, was about presidents and the books they wrote. So I'm proud of that book. There's a lot of stuff in there for book lovers, but it was very much a book about ideas. So when I thought about writing another book, I thought I wanted to tell a big adventure story. Mm-hmm. And what is the greatest American adventure story? It's Lewis and Clark. But it was important to me that I had something new to tell, too, that this wasn't just rehashing some of the other great books that have been written about this. So I started by reading the captain's journals. And one of the moments where I realized I only know half the story, there's so much more to explore here, was early on, before the captains had even left St. Louis, before the expedition had officially begun. There was this one sentence where Clark says that York, and York is the black man that Clark enslaved who went on the whole expedition, York commenced sawing with a whipsaw. And I remember thinking, well, what's a whipsaw do? Okay, that makes planks. You need those planks to build beds or build roofs. It's an important tool, especially if winter is staring down at you and you've got to get, you know, your shelter built. Why did they pick York? There were dozens of white soldiers there who could have done this. They picked York because he was skilled and because they needed his skills. Okay, well, how did those skills affect his relationship to Clark? How did those skills affect his relationship to the soldiers? And from that one little detail of the whipsaw, I felt like I was able to unspool so much about York until we end up with him making it to the Pacific Ocean and deciding, you know, I'm going to ask for my freedom. There are so many details like that in the journals if we just take the time to look. So that's kind of what convinced me that this is worth doing. I had the big adventure story, and I had the other half the story that many people don't know.
Fascinating. Well, it also strikes me that this book and how you've organized it kind of peels back the details on a cast of characters that represent different strata of American life. The 1800s are coming. I mean, you deal with Thomas Jefferson, you deal with Lewis, it's very kind of a toward the elite. Clark is maybe the next level down, and then all these soldiers that were a part of the aspect. York, you mentioned, is enslaved, and then the Native Americans along the way. So it's really a eye-opening in a lot of ways, and to a great degree, in my mind, you've successfully kind of given them their voice, or used their voice to describe.
I really appreciate you saying that. I love biography, and you know, there have been great biographies written of Lewis and Clark and Jefferson, but I've always kind of viewed biography as a shortcut or a superpower. You know, as a reader, I know when I'm reading a biography, when I can see the world the way that the subject sees the world, it's more fun to read, but I also feel like I kind of connect in a different way. So it was just important to me that superpower was not just reserved for Lewis and Clark. I wanted to spread that around. And so in the book, the chapters rotate. There are still plenty of chapters from Lewis's and Clark's point of view, and I found a lot of new stuff about them too. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, there are chapters from York's point of view, Sacagawea's point of view, other Native people's point of view, even John Ordway. I think it's, you know, we imagine Lewis and Clark, but they were very rarely the ones standing in a cold river towing a canoe. They had different responsibilities, but also a different experience. So John Ordway, one of my favorite people in the book, is a working class sergeant, and his version of those 8,000 miles was a lot different than Lewis and Clark's, and I wanted his version in the story too.
He comes through very clearly. In fact, I began to think Sergeant Ordway is a maybe Sam Elliott kind of character in a movie, right? I mean, you could immediately grasp the maybe the prototypical early 19th century NCO who's making the officer's wishes actually happen with a group of men who are, fact of the matter is, they're not the finest soldiers in the world. So
I love that. Yeah, and there's this line from Ordway's that to me kind of was the key to understanding him, where this is during another winter when they're all kind of coming down with the flu, and he's like, "I am full of pains, but not very sick." And that's just such a tough thing to say. But now that you've said this, I can hear Sam Elliott's voice saying it. Yeah. We're just like that baritone coming through the mustache. I am full of pains, but not very sick. And you're just like, well, okay, I get it. I get why you're a good sergeant. I get why you were essential to this expedition.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's go through a little bit. How did you, you mentioned this already, how the book is organized, which I find to be a very revealing way to look at the entire thing, the expedition, but also through this kind of biographical snapshot. Did you organize your previous book like that? Or is this something new? And I can imagine your first, you know, pitch to the editor about this organizational dynamic. What were some of those discussions like? Because this could go sideways in many different ways. So how did you discipline yourself to keep on track?
Much like the expedition, it's a good idea in theory, but then once we actually get out there, you know, we could have an upturned barge in no time at all.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the journals are what saved me. The journals are such a remarkable source. And like I said, with York and the Whipsaw, there's so much nuance in it. It's more than a million words. And so when you have a source that rich, you can read it in different ways and emphasize it in different ways. And so what I did was, once my editor and I agreed, you know, it might be time to take another look at this topic, it might be time to bring more perspectives into this topic, I just read the whole journals. That was the second time I read them at that point, and I kind of just read them for structure. And so the book still tells the classic adventure story. You know, we still start near St. Louis, we still cross the Rockies, we still spend plenty of time in South Dakota, still get to the Pacific Ocean. But at different steps, it sort of switches. Like, well, let's check in on York. Let's check in on Sacagawea. Let's check in on Lewis with his science experiments. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of figured that out over the course of, I don't know, a month or two, rereading the journals and just thinking, you know, well, I want to start with the Lewis chapter. Okay, the next chapter, it could be Clark, but Clark's biography and York's biography are very intertwined. So what if I made it a York biography? So even people who know the basics of Clark's life will see it differently because we're telling it from York's point of view. I just kind of mapped it out reading the journals, and that first outline I made, this was back in 2021 probably, it's still what was in the book. The roadmap actually worked. We can't say that for the expedition, unfortunately, because they ran into the Rockies. But for me, at least, the plan that I made, it worked, and it really shaped how I read the journals too. Another thing that always sticks out to me, and Lewis and Clark super fans know this, it's the portable soup. This is one of the beloved details where Lewis puts together these canisters of basically like gelatinous concentrate that can be reconstituted into soup if you have water. It's kind of emergency rations. They had to try that in the Rockies. That was important, and you know, it was good planning on Lewis's part. But it just so happened that as I was structuring all this, that the Rockies chapter was from Sacagawea's point of view. And so I was trying to think, what was this like for her? And I remembered a couple things. I remembered that, you know, she obviously had an infant with her, and I thought about my own wife with our kids and breastfeeding and how hungry she was and how thirsty she was. And so she was, you know, I did some research that adds 500 calories a day. So nobody was hungrier in the Rockies than Sacagawea was. But at the same time, I interviewed Shoshone people and they reminded me that they have a very strict taboo against eating horse flesh. So as we know in the Rockies, some of the men were so hungry that they started killing and eating their horses. But Sacagawea, who's the hungriest of all of them, couldn't do that. So maybe the portable soup was more important to her than anybody else because she needed those nutrients. She couldn't use the nutrients they had. Maybe when we think of the portable soup, we should think of Sacagawea. And that sort of emerged out of that structure and out of that stage of kind of trying to think, how can I take this puzzle apart and then put it together in a way that feels fresh?
Well, just as an aside then. So the last time I read a book-length treatment of Lewis and Clark was Stephen Ambrose's book that came out in the 90s. And I was an Air Force officer at the time and a part of a special operations unit in England, reading his book and thinking, these guys, this is a special operations team. They're dealing with, they're not so much high value hostage rescue or something like that, but they are dealing with indigenous people, different people along the way, struggling with language and translation, struggling with different cultural taboos and stepping on cultural landmines in almost every interaction, mm-hmm. and then walking away thinking, well, that went okay, when really it was a total disaster, and them not recognizing that in some cases till years later, if ever. So I read that book in the mid-90s, and then my next assignment was to go to get my master's degree in history at the University of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And Gary Moulton's multi-volume editions of the Lewis and Clark journals were being released, and Stephen Ambrose came to campus to talk about. And Ambrose said something I thought was one of the greatest compliments a historian could ever get. He said, Meriwether Lewis was supposed to publish these journals and never did. And then he's standing on the stage in this big auditorium, lean auditorium at the University of Nebraska, and he points to Gary Moulton and he said, he did what Thomas Jefferson wanted. He's accomplished that, finally. The whole room just felt like, wow, here's this effort that's been nearly 200 years in the making by that point, and it's finally done, and here's this history professor at the University of Nebraska just beavered away at this issue for decades. And yeah. And then 20 years later, a gentleman like you comes along and says, how can I take that timeline, this very detailed editorial or editing of these journals that Lewis and Clark kept, and reveal so much more about them?
Yeah, Moulton's editorial efforts are phenomenal. I mean, he spent decades on it, and you can tell. Yeah. And he kind of gave us the final version of the text where we can, you know, if you want to read the journals closely, you want to know that the text you're reading is reliable, just in the same way Shakespeare scholars need the best version of the text too.
Right.
And so Moulton did that, and it's incredible because, like I said, we're talking more than a million words, and there are so many details that have always been in there. It's just you need to take the time to listen. The other thing I'll say is that the University of Nebraska has created a fantastic digital edition of this. I got some of Moulton's books in print, especially his Atlas, which was really important because I still feel like the maps are overlooked. But I learned so much just by taking the time to look at Clark's actual maps instead of, you know, looking at modern maps.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the print edition is great, but the online one, free, indexed, really valuable and available to any of your listeners. So, you know, start with my book because I'll give you the overview. And there's a lot of stuff in my book that's not in the journals. But if you get into a Lewis and Clark phase, which I highly encourage you to do, journals are there and online, and you can look up it's all indexed by modern locations. So if you're from a small town in South Dakota, you find that in the index, find out how close they came. It's absolute cutting edge editorial scholarship.
Let's speaking of Thomas Jefferson, then your chapter on Jefferson is revealing as well. And I'd like to take you back. You talk about, and you do this remarkably well, given all of the, we'll just say, political viewpoints can spur one down one path versus another. I think you explain Jefferson in his own terms, based on the documents and the things that he said and the things that he wrote. And then to talk about this concept of preemption. This is kind of key to the whole understanding of what Jefferson thought he could accomplish. So
first, I appreciate you saying that because that's what I tried to do in the book. That's what biography is, right? It's helping you see the world the way people did. So whether I was writing about Jefferson or Wolfcalf or York or Lewis, I wanted to say, what did they care about? What mattered to them? How did they see the world? And can I capture that? You know, this is a book about 1804, not a book about 2026. So preemption is something that previous Lewis and Clark people haven't grappled with, but and so I found it kind of by reading the newest academic scholarship. But what's funny is once I knew what to look for, it's everywhere in the expedition documents. It's one of those, it's like a note you can't hear until you know to listen to it. But in short, let's use the Louisiana Purchase as our case study.
Sure.
In school, you learn Louisiana Purchase doubled the size of America. It's the greatest real estate greatest real estate deal in American history. None of that is true. What the Louisiana Purchase was not a purchase of land. It was a purchase of preemption rights. France was the imperial nation that under this doctrine, kind of called the Law of Nations, claimed the preemption rights to all that territory. But that didn't mean they actually owned the land. The various imperial nations understood that native people owned the land and even more held the real on-the-ground power there. But if the native people ever wanted to sell, or if there was a war and they lost their land, France was the one who kind of had first dibs. They had the opportunity to preempt that. And so when France sold the Louisiana Purchase to Jefferson and the Americans, they did not sell the land. They sold the preemption rights, which meant that America was the one who could then step in. But at the same time, all that land was still owned by the native people. Jefferson called this idea the right of soil. And so one historian, a guy named Robert Lee at Cambridge, has gone through and tracked how much did all those treaties that actually led to the land transfers cost. It was more than $400 million, and that's in 1804 dollars. Right. So when you think of the Louisiana Purchase, it's not $15 million. It's not a great deal. It's more than $415 million. So that's kind of the theoretical framework. Lewis understood this. Clark understood this. Jefferson certainly understood this. But that also gives you a different way to understand what the expedition was up to. Lewis and Clark and Jefferson knew it was about land. They knew that they wanted this land someday. They didn't know exactly when that day would come, but they were constantly thinking about preemption. They wanted to know, even before the Louisiana Purchase happened, they were thinking about the Pacific Northwest and the Pacific Ocean and how to establish America's preemption claims out there. And the best example that I know this, and that I'm not projecting some kind of modern scholarship onto this, is that when Lewis ran into some grizzly bears, he was talking about how tenacious they were. And he said they were very protective of their right of soil. That's the Jefferson word. And it's such a great joke. I think Lewis
is applying that onto the grizzly bear.
Exactly. He's like, we do not have preemption with these grizzlies. These grizzlies still hold the land. And so you can tell that that idea was everywhere in the planning of the expedition, and that Jefferson, you know, he cared about science. He cared about history. He cared about diplomacy, but he also cared about land. Of course, the people who were living on that land cared about their land too. And that's one of the kind of clashes that emerges in this story.
Well, and you show the timeline too. A lot of people, and I was probably a few years ago when I was reminded of this, that the purchase occurs after the planning for the expedition is well underway. The Louisiana Purchase is just kind of happenstance and brought about largely because of the desire to get New Orleans back into the trading game, not necessarily
right
by that. And but
yeah,
but Lewis and Jefferson are planning this because, in the words of, you had a phrase in there, the President Washington viewed forts as a way to keep settlers and Indians from fighting, in an ideal sense. That was the reason you put them there. Jefferson views them for, well, I'll let you say it. What's Jefferson's reason for the fort?
Well, he views them as a way to acquire land.
Yeah.
And it's a peaceful way to do it, and it's a consensual way to do it. But still, the goal is clear. Jefferson, in a private letter to William Henry Harrison, talks about, you know, we want native leaders to go into debt at our trading posts because then they'll be more predisposed to sell us the land that we need. And so Jefferson didn't like wars, and he didn't want to kill people, and he thought wars were expensive. But he still wanted land, and he thought that trade was the easiest way to get it.
Now, another thing, too, that's fun to read about in your book is this close tie between Meriwether Lewis and Thomas Jefferson, and that Lewis he's literally taking the secret bill to Congress to get the appropriation through the House and the Senate. I mean, he's a staffer for President Jefferson and is a part and parcel of these negotiations that are going, and so that kind of thing is very revealing about the relationship he has with the president.
Yeah, he was Jefferson's secretary. And when we think that word, we think he's just copying out Jefferson's speeches. But I mean, Jefferson had a technological gizmo to do that for
him.
what Lewis was he was the chief of staff. I mean, if we're going to draw a modern analogy.
Yeah.
And I really tried to pay attention to the way the expedition got funded. I sort of tried to do a Robert Caro kind of power broker attempt to understand how did Jefferson get this through. Because 1803 was very partisan. The two sides did not like each other, and on every new issue, they were going to try to score political points. So the expedition barely got through Congress. It's very easy to imagine a world where it doesn't get approved because of partisan politics, and the Lewis and Clark expedition never happens. And if you read the documents really closely, and I was also able to find some new letters, this is one of the things that took the longest, but you know, obviously Jefferson's letters, there's not a lot new there to find. They've been edited really well. But all of the other people in Washington, their letters sometimes don't get studied. So I just went and looked at different senators and representatives, and I would read all of their letters written in this session of Congress when the expedition got passed.
Right.
And I found lots of new stuff about this. And like you said, Lewis was tracking this. Lewis was the guy who was going between the White House and the Capitol building. Pennsylvania Avenue was pretty empty. You know, you'd pass partridges, but not much else.
Yeah.
But other than that, it was still kind of the political world we know today, where you're counting votes. You're trying to figure out, how do I prevent defections? How do I keep the press on my side?
Right.
Jefferson was strategizing about all that because he wanted to get this expedition funded. And he did. But it was a close call, and really a case study in presidential power.
Well, and then the news comes that the French are willing to sell the land, and now he looks like a genius, Jefferson does.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then all of a sudden his party gets more popular. They start winning landslide elections. Yeah. And by the time Lewis and Jefferson come home, the country looks totally different. But if you read Moulton's journals closely, you know, when they start running into traitors on the way back, one of the first questions they ask is, did Jefferson win re-election? Because when they left, they didn't know.
That's right. Well, before we get one more thing I wanted to cover before we get too far down the expedition path is this, and maybe is the Washington cabinet meeting when Jefferson is Secretary of State and Washington, President Washington is trying to understand, was trying to formulate a policy for the American Indians and how should the United States government treat them? Should we buy land from individuals or are they tribes? And if they're tribes, are they sovereign? And he seems to, Washington does, seems to come down, well, no, they are sovereign. They're sovereign, independent nations. And how are we going to deal with them? And Jefferson is pushing an angle that the others in the cabinet aren't necessarily agreeing with. And I'm wondering if you can kind of, first off, how did you come across meetings of that or evidence of that meeting? And then can you kind of explain everybody's points of view?
Well, we're talking a lot about ideas like preemption, but I really tried to write a page-turning book. I wanted this to be a book where you were kind of, you know, moving along. Yeah. And so I remember thinking, you know, I've got to get these preemption ideas in here. They are not in any other book on the expedition, but they are in the expedition documents. Like, this is a history that people have to know if they want to understand what Jefferson cared about. But nobody wants to read 7 pages of me talking about preemption. So that's where I kind of settled on this cabinet meeting because it's one of the early, it's a really important cabinet meeting and there are good documents that survive because Jefferson took notes. Of course, his notes, you know, we have to read them carefully because he's going to tell his side of things. And Alexander Hamilton is in this meeting with his side of things. But I knew that, you know, I could play with some favorite moments from American history and some favorite rivalries with Jefferson and Hamilton.
Yeah.
So I tried to use this cabinet meeting as a way to have some fun while also conveying these ideas about preemption because Jefferson was talking about preemption during the meeting itself. And you're absolutely right that Washington and Knox underneath him and Jefferson and Hamilton, they all saw Native people as sovereign nations. That's how it all got codified in the Constitution too. And, and we still see the effects of that today in how various Native nations interact with the federal government. But even though Jefferson respected that, even though he had a line in his notes on the meeting where he said, you know, we have to respect the Native people's claim to the land, and we have to understand they may never give that up. They may just decide to keep it forever. You know, it was Jefferson basically declaring independence for another nation, not just our own. But then what Jefferson said was, we have to protect preemption. We have to protect these legal mechanisms because eventually the circumstances will be right for that, for us to claim that land, for us to buy that land. And so you can see that even though Jefferson is fighting with Hamilton and trying to please Washington and has all these political things to worry about, his eyes are always sort of drawn to the West and thinking someday there's going to be a way for us to incorporate that land and to profit from that land and to create the kind of agrarian economy that Jefferson believed was essential to the American identity.
Well, and I think that's key. He kind of loses that argument, but then when he wins election of the presidency himself, of course, he's the master of that.
We're still having versions of that argument today, right? Jefferson versus Hamilton. It doesn't map onto modern parties the way you think, but the ideas are very much still in play.
That's right, in so many ways. I think examining, well, as the musical has made clear, you can examine that relationship, and just it is very revealing about the United States. If Washington had burned into American tradition as well as law, his view of how to treat American Indian tribes, how might the United States look different today? Let's just play a little parlor game.
That's a really interesting question because Jefferson was so much more interested in expansion than Washington and than Adams too. You know, Adams also had a different kind of native policy than Jefferson did. So Jefferson pushed hard and pushed fast. And the thing about history is if things break in a slightly different way, you really don't know. You know, if Lewis and Clark had a battle with the Lakota and the expedition would have ended and, you know, it would have taken years to send out another expedition and British fur traders in North Dakota and South Dakota put a bigger hold there and Native nations start dealing with the British more than the Americans, is Canada a lot bigger today than it is today? Do Native nations hold on to their power longer and create a different kind of relationship in terms of, you know, their relationship to Canadian politics or American politics today? There's so many, you know, hinge points between then and now. But at the very least, I think, you know, Jefferson's desire to expand and Jefferson's desire to create the conditions where other Americans could expand was essential. And the other thing that Jefferson did was he used state power, I guess is the way political scientists would describe it today. You can think about Lewis and Clark in a lot of different ways, but one thing they were is they were, you know, a federal mission. Yeah. Their budget was the same percent of the federal budget back then that NASA is today. Oh, and so Jefferson, even though Jefferson's a small government guy in many ways, yeah, when it comes to expansion, no check is too big.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing where, you know, Washington might not have wanted to put those kinds of federal resources into the West. Jefferson did. And then that creates knock-on effects to presidents like Lincoln, who are thinking about, you know, transcontinental railroads and everything like that. So it's all really interesting, and the ideas all connect.
Internal improvements. That was the newspaper line or the story for a century as America is expanding West. Is it the federal government's responsibility to make improvements of roads and bridges?
Right. And Jefferson's line, the name he gave the bill to fund Lewis and Clark, was extending the external commerce. And when it comes to politicians, it's those bland titles that should worry you. If they give it a name that feels kind of like something your utility company might be doing, that's when you know it's a big, ambitious project that could change a continent.
Well, let's spend a little time getting to know Lewis and Clark through the John Ordway or his soldiers. And how is this team put together? It's not quite the, you know, SEAL Team 6, right? It's I was kind of surprised to learn it was just happens to be much of them seem to be just the soldiers who happened to be on duty in the St. Louis area at the time. And they kind of had to pick and choose and take what they could. So it runs through that because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, sometimes Lewis and Clark sort of bear the wrath of their fellow officers. Maybe those officers were a little jealous that they weren't the ones getting to do this because, you know, the expedition was huge news at the time. It was a viral news story. It was covered in newspapers around the country constantly. So I think there was some jealousy at play. But, you know, they would give Lewis and Clark not the best boats. They would give them not the best soldiers. So there were a couple times where Lewis and Clark could choose. You know, Clark recruited some civilians around Louisville, Kentucky. And there, Clark had longstanding family relationships, and he could really pick some men who would go on to be some of the most important people in the expedition, including York, by the way, who was really vital at several points. But then as they would stop at forts along the way, you know, at one fort, I remember reading a letter from one of the soldiers' granddaughters who talked about, you know, my grandfather would tell me that more than 100 people tried out, and he was one of the only ones chosen. So sometimes it would be more selective, but sometimes these soldiers would show up and Clark would just write a note to Lewis because they were separate sometimes in this planning stage. And Clark would just be like, these guys are not great. And so it was, and let's be honest too, that a lot of the soldiers in this period were not great. Being a soldier did not pay well. It was not respected in the way that, you know, I think most Americans respect soldiers today. So it was viewed as kind of a violent and unstable profession. Most of the people were soldiers because they didn't have better options. But I also think this shows something really cool about Lewis and Clark, which is that most officers responded to the problem of you know, troop quality, let's say, with violence. You know, I found example after example in the various archives of officers, you know, a civilian comes and says, I think some of your soldiers stole something from our store. And the officer just says, okay, and just starts beating a soldier until one of them confesses. Yeah. That was a guy named Cornelius Lyman, who's actually John Ordway's first captain, the guy that he was recruited by. But Lewis and Clark went in the complete opposite direction. They tried to avoid violence. They tried to incorporate the men's opinions. They gave the men a chance to vote, which is more like a militia than like the soldiers. And they really wanted the men to feel like they were part of the mission, and they wanted the men to be independent. Because once they got far away from American society, they didn't know what they were going to run into. And so they needed men who could act for themselves, and they needed men who cared about the mission as well. So one of the things I'm most proud of in the book is that I think it's the most comprehensive understanding of what Lewis and Clark did as military officers. And it shows that what they did was radical. It was as much an experiment as any of the science. They tried to do something new, and it worked.
They're piecing their way through. And I think that, well, it's clearly a level of maturity that some gray-haired colonel who might have been on many expeditions and built up different teams to do different things would have. But these guys, they're young men. How old are they in 1804?
Lewis is 29, Clark's 33.
Okay. Well, and then bring up a little sideline. Clark's appointment to captain fails to come through, and he just lives with it.
And that's one of those
day and age, the honor besmirched. You can just see him going off and and maybe threatening a duel with the Secretary of War or somebody like that. But he doesn't do that. He just keeps it to himself. And
yeah,
certainly hurts, but it's the mission, right?
Yeah, so. Even years after the expedition, somebody asked him about it, and he said in a letter, "My feelings on this were as might be expected." And yeah. The icy understatement there, you can tell he is still furious. But, I mean, the truth is he cared about Lewis. He cared about his country. Yeah. He cared about his men. So he was willing to set all that aside, proceed on.
And I have to say, reading the chapter about Clark, he certainly comes off, in my estimation, as a human being greater than I had expected to find. Largely, I think people, and quite rightly, you know, he's his relationship with York is one of master and slave, and he certainly exhibits that cruelty from time to time when he thinks he needs to. But other than that, you pointed to the fact that he had a little college, which, you know, his spelling would indicate that he can barely read, but you show that, well, he went to William & Mary.
That's our best guess.
Yeah.
And it was kind of fun how I found that. I haven't told this story before, but I was, you know, this was when I was working on the York chapter, which the second chapter is York's chapter. And so I was just like, you know, I was reading all the slave narratives I could find from enslaved people who had lived in Kentucky. And I was just looking for anything that was not just from an enslaved person's perspective, but from Kentucky, because slavery was very different in Kentucky versus Virginia or other areas. And so I saw somebody mention, hey, there's a white guy from Kentucky who wrote an autobiography, and he had a black body servant with him. So that's exactly the Clark York relationship. And I was like, I got to track this down. So the University of Chicago had a copy of it, and they scanned it for me, so I didn't even have to go there. And so I get this document and it's PDF, and I'm really excited, and I open it, and I'm not kidding. The first sentence is this white officer saying, on such and such a day, I headed from Virginia back to Kentucky. On the boat with me was a young lieutenant named William Clark.
Holy smoke. Like,
what? Are you serious? And so I, of course, had a little more work to do. I needed to make sure it was the same William Clark. I needed to make sure it checked out. It all did. But in the autobiography, the guy said William Clark was at college in Virginia, and he was heading back because he was ready to join the military after a year in college. It was very normal to go to college for just a year at that time.
Yeah.
And so then at the Missouri Historical Society, there's a notebook that nobody has ever really known what to make of, where it's in Clark's handwriting, but it's just copying out lots of textbooks. And what I realized was that's his college notebook.
Oh,
you know, I used Google Books and would take phrases, and I kind of put together the syllabus that he worked from.
Yeah.
And then I shared it with some historians who have studied colleges in this time period. And they know this material so well that they would say, okay, this is the book he read about astronomy. We're 99% sure he was at William & Mary, because that's the astronomy curriculum that they used.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is so cool to put together. But it's, you know, it's a fun story. It was certainly a lot of fun for me to find that.
Right.
But it also makes us look at Clark differently, because the easy way to think about this is like Lewis is the brooding intellectual. Clark is kind of the people pleaser who's making the trains run on time.
Right.
And there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
But both captains served both roles at different times.
Right.
And Clark really saw the world in Enlightenment terms. And, you know, once I knew the college education, once I started paying attention to this part of his personality, the journals are full of places where he's just very curious, you know. The men will go past a cliff on the Missouri and they'll see a painting by native people. The enlisted soldiers will just be like, that's a picture of the devil. And they clearly are uncomfortable from it. Clark will take the time to reproduce it, to draw the painting, and then write about it, because that's what you do as an Enlightenment thinker, right? You're gathering information. You're trying to understand culture. You believe that native people can change over time to become more like your culture. Clark learned all that in college, and he applied it on the expedition. Again, we just had to take the time to look.
A few episodes ago, I had Kara Rogers on the show to talk about her new book on Thomas Jefferson and his fight against slavery. And she talked about the politics on the campus of William & Mary just before Jefferson showed up, and kind of how the faculty, the string of events that led to Jefferson's education, and then his formulation of the Notes on the State of Virginia. So it was interesting to see here that that's an assigned text at William & Mary 30 years later, and that a man like William Clark is reading that and thinking about these things and kind of anthropological terms, kind of like Jefferson was, you know, from Enlightenment influences and so forth, putting all this together. So yeah, it made perfect sense to me after I saw it in print. You didn't have to sell me too closely in the argument. I think that he went to William & Mary, because I think it makes sense that he did, and despite his spelling. So Nobody cared about spelling, though, to give him a break.
That's what I mean. Jefferson said this in letters, and so I certainly don't mind having a bit of fun. I hope my book is a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, reading all this scholarship, I'm like, can we cut Clark some slack? Like, how many more jokes do I need to read about Clark spelling? He was on a barge trying to stay alive, trying to keep 30 troublemakers in line. Like, he didn't have Microsoft Word. Let's cut him some slack. Which is what I tried to do.
Well, and you mentioned elections. It's often been stated to me by people that the first election in South Dakota is the Lewis and Clark expedition, when they elect a new sergeant to replace Sergeant Floyd, who dies from probably an appendicitis rupture or something right around Sioux City. That, I think that's, well, it's kind of interesting, but your point is well taken that they treated it like a militia unit would elect their NCOs, their officers to some degree, and that the men would participate in this because they are, indeed, you can't just ship the guy off to a court-martial and then off to the stockade, because there isn't any of that, right? You've got to handle it. So
yeah, and it's so interesting, too, that I found more examples of these kinds of elections. Like, just by reading the journals carefully, before they left St. Louis, it talks about when they were sorting the men into different squads that they were balloted for. But if you look it up in the OED and look at other examples, that meant that the men voted and chose. And I think it's fascinating. This is the kind of experiment I was talking about, that Lewis and Clark let their men have so much input. But it's also really interesting when we get to a York chapter, because very famously, York and to a lesser extent, Sacagawea had a chance to vote on where winter quarters would be on the Pacific Ocean. That's a powerful moment. But to me, it's only more powerful if we know there have been four or five moments where they could vote up to that point, and the captains did not include York. But finally, at that last one, they do include York. That kind of shift, I think, tells you about York's contributions, and it makes it only more meaningful to know that this unit has always operated in this way, but now he's being brought into that kind of fraternity in some real way.
Now, he's never on any Army list, right? He has no status as far as the United States Army is concerned. York has no status.
Nobody ever listed his height or anything like that, but in the rosters, before they left the Pacific Ocean, they made a lot of rosters to pass out to other traders, and Lewis included York and Sacagawea on those.
I think the conversation or the chapter you have on Black Buffalo is particularly rich, and so let's spend a good bit of time on that. I wonder if you could kind of hone in on their path down the Missouri and everyone who's coming from that region. By the way, it's like a super highway. I mean, it's not that bad, but they're getting a lot of intel from people who have just been there. And when we often think of Lewis and Clark, we think of, there's no white people there, but there was a fair amount, and they had some pretty good intel, and they definitely were coached up on who the tribes, which tribes would be a problem and which tribe would would be less of a problem, and who was the threat. With that as a bit of a background, I wonder if you can talk about, as they're approaching then what is today Sioux City and getting north of Council Bluffs, how are they, what's their big scare?
Well, I think you've put your finger on something really important, which is to just understand how powerful Native people were in this time period in this area. And when I say that previous accounts only tell you half the story, this is exactly what I mean. Quick example, that where they built Fort Mandan, there were five Native towns around there, Mandan and Hidatsa people. And the combined population of that was four times St. Louis's population. It was bigger than Washington, D.C. was at that time. Wow. So it's not a modern idea that we're saying here, that like Native people held the power. They had more people. They had more knowledge. They controlled this area. Jefferson's phrase, when he talked about the America's presence in the Lakota Territory, he said, we are, quote, miserably weak. Now, the expedition wasn't miserably weak. They're, you know, 40 people, very well armed.
Yeah.
They're a military mission. But still, they understood that, you know, they were in another nation's territory. And the most important leader of that nation, that other nation, was Black Buffalo. So the encounter between the Lakota and Lewis and Clark is one of the most famous episodes in the expedition. And I tried to offer, a really fresh account. One of the things is that most people see it as a near failure, as the worst foreign policy Lewis and Clark did. That's completely wrong. It was the best foreign policy that they did. There's a transcript from 1807 after they get back where Just Clark meets with some Lakota leaders. And if you read that transcript, which for whatever reason, most historians haven't really grappled with, you can see that the relationship between the Southern Lakota and the Americans was pretty good. And that continued through the War of 1812 and after. So it's a story that ended with kind of a mutual respect. But it is true that the first days of that story were very tense. And so I really tried to tell that episode from Black Buffalo's point of view, because there have been lots of people who've written about the American point of view. But it's really interesting to think about what the Lakota wanted, because, you know, Jefferson, Lewis, Clark, they wanted to use the Lakota. They wanted to create new trade relationships. They wanted to gather information. They wanted to find ways to leverage them for America's benefit. But the Lakota thought about this the exact same way. Black Buffalo wanted to leverage Lewis and Clark. He wanted to use the Americans for Lakota benefits. He had a really strong rivalry with the Partisan, which you can see this through the journals. And I've also been able to confirm it by looking at old winter counts, by talking to Lakota people and hearing their traditions. It, just as an aside, I think these kinds of sources work best in conversation. If you compare the journals to the native traditions and then the winter counts and all this stuff, that's how you get the best and most accurate account. But Black Buffalo, his biggest worry wasn't Lewis and Clark. It was this guy named the Partisan, who led the second biggest band of the Sikongu, which was kind of the subdivision of the Lakota that we're talking about. And so Black Buffalo wanted more trade with the Americans. The Partisan wanted more violence. He wanted more control. And so there was a real rivalry between them, and both men were sort of trying to use this new group of outsiders to persuade their nation to take their side. And in the end, Black Buffalo won. He was able to persuade, he was able to convince, he was able to prevent violence. But if we view the relationship between the Lakota and Lewis and Clark as really important and valuable to both sides, it's important to say that the person most responsible for that outcome wasn't Lewis or Clark, it was Black Buffalo.
And Black Buffalo's shrewd enough to understand, well, his point of view is long held, more than likely, and again, a wise course of action given what he's seen go on with trading from the French and the British and now the Americans happening, and knowing that if Partisan's view comes to be the predominant one, then the whole thing can go up in smoke.
I totally agree. And Black Buffalo was just such an interesting guy. We're really lucky that there was a different trader. Like you said, there were a lot of white people in this area. And there was a different trader who lived with the Arikara the year before and kept a very detailed journal that survived. It's survived in a couple of different versions, actually. And I made sure to read both versions, even though one of them has never been translated, because slightly different, you know, phrasings can tell you a lot. And so we're lucky to have this, so we can really know Black Buffalo pretty well, because there were other traders near the Lakota at this time period. And, you know, they were French. And so the Partisan would storm into their fort and sort of, you know, he would pretend that he was an employee working there. He would jump behind the counter, rifle through their goods, and they didn't have any way to stop him. So they kind of appealed to Black Buffalo and said, hey, can you stop this? And Black Buffalo said, according to this trader, you know, the French aren't in my care. I don't really care. Yeah. And that he was very slow to act. He was very, yeah. He had a dry sense of humor, and his priority was the Lakota people and their way of life. Yeah. But if you know that context, then you can see that what he's doing with Lewis and Clark is radical for him. That if he's somebody who generally would just say hands off and not get that involved, the fact that he was so quick to respond to Lewis and Clark lets you know that A, he's probably sick of the Partisan at this point and sick of all these stunts and all this trouble.
Yeah.
B, he knows how much weaponry the Americans have, and see, he realizes strategically, this is my time to act. If I go all in right here, I can bring my nation to my side, I can solidify my control, and I can make sure my people go in the direction I want. That's stuff that you can understand by reading that other source, that's stuff you can understand by reading the journals, and then that's stuff that's confirmed by the Lakota people I talked to about Black Buffalo. He's a really fascinating human being. And, you know, he doesn't get as much attention as some of the later Lakota leaders that are really famous names, but I think he belongs in that pantheon. He was essential to his people and their progress.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of lines we could pick up in conversations we could go down on that, but it's a really rich chapter. And I think, well, the name, the Partisan, it strikes me as, do you know anything how he got that name? Is that I assume it's a French translation of a Lakota word, which means a man who leads raids or something like that, because that's
it is a French translation, but I think it was just, they would sometimes call war leaders partisans. And so there's a moment in Zebulon Pike's journals where he talks about a partisan, and I was like, oh, could this be the same guy? But when I read it closely, clearly it was just kind of a nickname.
Okay.
But that's the name that this guy is known best by. And I was always having to make this choice, you know, Sacagawea. Do I call her Sacagawea? Yeah. Do I call her Woman? Do I call her Boat Pusher? You know, that's a very intense and political debate today.
Yes.
So what I generally tried to do with Native people was, you know, if somebody had been known by a certain name for a long time, I would kind of keep that so readers who did bring some pre-existing knowledge wouldn't be as confused. But
yeah.
The Partisan did have a Lakota name that Lewis and Clark preserved in the journals. Go to Gary Moulton's journals and you can read all the theories about what the Partisan's real name is. It's all there online.
Okay. I'll have to check that out. What's the blow-by-blow of these 4 or 5 days that the Lewis and Clark expedition spends with this, caught in the middle, essentially, between Black Buffalo and the Partisan? Walk through the events of that.
Yeah, the first day is really tense. The first day starts out with a kind of diplomatic meeting, and from Lewis and Clark's point of view, they've already had one of these, so they understand how to offer gifts and sort of give their speech through a kind of translation chain, and they think, well, you know, we'll tell our story, and then, you know, we'll hear what they have to say, we'll give some gifts, and we'll move on. But it doesn't go that way, because before they're able to do that, Lakota people who were affiliated with the Partisan start doing things like grabbing the rope line so a boat can't move and start really making threats. And so it ends up with Clark on the shore with his sword pulled out with just a couple soldiers around him, all of the Lakota right next to him. And then, of course, the barge with its cannons, John Ordway, the sergeant we've talked about, he's, you know, quickly loading all the weaponry pointed at this group of Lakota. I mean, hundreds of people would have died. And the Americans thought that they would have lost this. I'm sure they would have fought as hard as they possibly could, but they were so outnumbered in terms of people that they would have ended up, all of the Americans would have ended up dying, but a lot of the Lakota would have ended up dying too. And that first day is one of those moments where you can really see Black Buffalo not being passive, not sort of waiting and seeing, but jumping in right away. And what he ended up doing is he spent that first night on the barge. And if you look at the maps and you pay really close attention to where the Lakota camps are positioned, you can tell that in a sort of private meeting, Black Buffalo basically said, move the Lakota camp to the river up ahead a little bit. I'll spend the night on the boat with Lewis and Clark. And then the next day, they'll kind of see the camp. So it's sort of a pivot from the Partisan's approach, which is violence and theatrics, to Black Buffalo's approach, which is, hey, here are the women and the children. Let's get to know each other better. The only way you can notice that is if you're thinking about Black Buffalo's point of view. If you're thinking about Lewis and Clark's point of view, I do, of course, account for what this felt like for them. Mm-hmm. That's one story. But you can see that Black Buffalo made a choice just in a group of Lakota people and said, let's move the camp. Let's do something different. So then day two, the boat moves on a little bit more, the barge and the two pierogues with it. And all of a sudden, they run into about 1,000 Lakota people who are spread out on this plain. And I'm really proud of the images in this book. I worked really hard to put really fresh images and new images and authentic images. You know, I didn't want a picture of a musket. I wanted a picture of the air rifle that Lewis probably used. And I was able to do that in a lot of cases. Yeah. And one of them is a painting of the Lakota that George Catlin made a couple decades later.
Okay.
And by looking at Clark's map, it's the exact same spot where the Lakota had moved on Black Buffalo's order. So if you want to know how did Lewis and Clark see the world, literally, this Catlin painting is the closest we will ever come. And so they come around this river bend and they see this huge grassy plain and they just see, you know, these beautiful teepees painted, lots of people, women and children, not just men. And so it's a much less threatening scene. And so for the next couple days, that's sort of the tenor of things. There's more negotiations. Also, there are times where Black Buffalo and the Lakota have their private negotiations where they're trying to figure out what kind of relationship do we want to have with the Americans. Lewis and Clark are, you know, with their men doing their own things as well. There are some Native traditions that some of the American men had sex with Lakota women. Maybe the captains did too. That's a rumor that's lasted for a long time and I think is very plausible. But long story short, it seemed like things were going better. It seemed like things were going Black Buffalo's way. And then on the last day, when it was time to leave, the Americans had been jumpy throughout. Everyone was sleep deprived. Everyone was stressed. They lost their anchor through kind of Three Stooges level of
right.
just a mistake, which happens.
Yep.
And so they're tied up right on the shoreline. It's time to leave. And once again, the Partisan and the soldiers who are aligned with him grab that rope and try to cause trouble, try to extract and demand more goods again. Once again, Black Buffalo doesn't waste any time, jumps right in, stops violence from escalating. And from then the Americans leave and head on. So it was kind of one of those things where it was very tense at the beginning, very tense at the end, kind of friendly but skeptical in the middle. It's
right.
Just a fascinating human drama, and thinking about it from all these different points of view, I can't imagine how interesting it was, but also how anxiety inducing it was. It's one of the most famous moments of the expedition for a reason.
Right. But then something that you do in your book is to use an article that we published 20 years ago at the South Dakota Historical Society Press,
mm-hmm.
and the Journal, to share a conversation that occurs later between William Clark, when he's now the Indian agent for all of Louisiana Territory, mm-hmm. back in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Partisan comes to negotiate something. He lets on kind of how that all transpired from his perspective, from the Parsons perspective. What that document reveals is amazing when you know about how that relationship started back in 1804.
Absolutely. And it's funny because the Partisan, you can tell that his pride is still hurting because one of the things he said is, you know, the other guy, meaning Black Buffalo, that other leader didn't have the courage to come see you. But everybody knew that, you know, real power is not having to go. The real power is that Black Buffalo said, you're going to go on this long trip. I don't have to go. Yeah. I have lieutenants and you're now one of my lieutenants.
Yeah.
And so in this negotiation, the Partisan kind of apologizes to Clark, which is not something he wanted to do, I'm sure. But again, it speaks to Black Buffalo kind of finally taking control of the Sikongu and steering them in the direction that he wanted to go. So Clark accepts the apology. Trade is restored, and it's the start of a really important relationship between the Southern Lakota and the Americans that lasts through the War of 1812 and after. And again, a lot of people, even some historians, want to sort of see anger and tension there that didn't exist after the expedition. The anger and the tension was with the Arikara, and sometimes the Arikara and the Lakota would work together, sometimes they wouldn't. But the problem on the Missouri wasn't Americans versus Lakota, it was the Americans versus the Arikara. But Lewis and Clark also have a really important role to play here, because Biahito, an Arikara leader who went all the way from South Dakota to Washington, D.C. to meet with Jefferson, and that's another chapter I'm really proud of, where I kind of capture the expedition in reverse, where he's going east to explore America. Biahito died just of old age. It wasn't anything nefarious. But of course, the Arikara didn't believe that. And so his death, because Lewis and Jefferson and Clark had such big foreign policy dreams of, we're going to have Native leaders travel thousands of miles and we're going to all become interconnected and we're all going to work together for commerce, those big dreams kind of blew up in their face. And you can almost think of it as sort of like regime change. You know, they're trying to go into an area they don't understand and sort of preach American values, but they don't understand how complicated it is. Right. And the troubles on the Missouri, they come from the Arikara, not the Lakota.
Right. In fact, in the 1820s, the United States Army, the Lakota, team up to fight a war against the Arikara.
Right. You can see the seeds of that in that document that you guys published, which is that 1807 meeting. And that document has been there. Just people would rather, you know, Clark has some unfortunate sound bites where he calls the Lakota vile miscreants and the pirates of the Missouri. But that was a rhetorical performance. Clark knew what he was doing. And if you can look past the sound bites and look at the actual documents, that's where you'll find the truth.
Yeah. Well, very revealing. Craig, this has been a great conversation. And I wondered if maybe we just wrap up here with, how does Sacagawea come into the story, and talk about her perspective a little bit, because I think that's certainly something that is broadly debated today about, do we even have the right Sacagawea? When does she pass away? What's her real name? Where does she come from to begin with? All of that. So,
I'm glad I get a chance to talk about her. I will never turn down a chance to talk about Sacagawea, because she's such an amazing person. And again, the journals preserve a lot about her if you'll just take the time to read it carefully. Another thing that really helped me understand her was newer scholarship by historians about Native slavery. Because, you know, people talk about Sacagawea and they're like, oh, she's Charbonneau's wife. I don't think that's the right word for it. I think she was Charbonneau's slave. And it's really important to note that Clark used this word in an interview he gave after the expedition when he was talking about Sacagawea and another Native woman. He said they were slaves. So again, this is not some modern imposition. This is just the more accurate understanding of what it was like on the ground. And so Sacagawea, I believe, was captured from the Shoshone by the Hidatsa. She was enslaved. Somehow Charbonneau bought or traded for her. And husband and wife, I don't think that's a fair representation of their relationship. We know from the journals that he beat her, he abused her, he impregnated her. He did that to multiple Native women. If you read other journals, this is through line of Charbonneau's entire life. But I will say that I think this makes Sacagawea more inspiring, not less inspiring. If you understand how brutal her formative years were, and then you see what she was able to accomplish, it makes it even more incredible what she was able to do, how she was able to help the expedition, but also how she was able to help herself. You know, this idea that she was a friendly guide, there's some truth to that. But the way I see it is, she was a friendly guide because she realized Lewis and Clark could help protect her. She realized Lewis and Clark could get her back to the Shoshone. So just like Black Buffalo was using the Americans, she was using the Americans too. I'm sure they all liked each other. But she also realized that, you know, if I can be indispensable to them, they can protect me and help me get back to my people. The other thing I'll say real quick is just that, you know, there's been debate lately about both where Sacagawea was born and where she died. In terms of where she was born, you know, I've read the scholarships. The Hidatsa have produced a really fascinating and important book that explores this, and that stuff, it was really illuminating to read. But I just think that the journals, and especially if you read the journals closely, you can tell where Sacagawea was telling her story herself, probably through sign language. It's very clear to me that she was born Shoshone. When she died, though, that I do think is an open question. I don't think we can say for sure. Did she die in 1812? That's what Clark thought, and there's some documents that support that, but they're hardly an open and shut case like the Lakota documents we were talking about. So did she live into the 1850s? Did she live into the 1860s? I think that's really possible, and I don't really take a stand on that in my book, other than to say the fact that so many nations see themselves in Sacagawea, that tells us first that her experience was a lot of Native women's experience. And it also tells us that she's just an amazing and inspiring person. Like, that there's a reason people are so interested in her, which is that she's just an incredible human being.
The epilogue that you write, and I liked how you crafted that notebook that William Clark is keeping. And he takes that out. And I wonder how did that idea occur to you to kind of sum up the book with this notebook of when Clark is reflecting on who's still living.
The way I always thought of the epilogue was kind of at the end of a good documentary movie or one of those movies that's based on true events where you kind of get the snapshots of everybody and just sort of like, where are they now, and kind of wrap up the story. Because this is a pretty long book. It's about 400 pages long in the main story. And I mean, compared to a lot of books in this genre, that's actually not that long. I tried to make the pages really turn. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after 400 pages, I thought, do we really need, you know, 6 pages on John Ordway's life as a farmer? Probably not. But we do need a few paragraphs because we do want to see how this story ends. So I knew I wanted to just like, of their 10 people who get their kind of point of view chapters. Black Buffalo is one of them, of course, and we've talked about most of the others as well. I wanted to sort of tie up the story for each one of these human beings, because this is really a human story. Like, this, there's history, there's politics, there's ideas, there's diplomacy, but the human beings are what I still think about. And so Clark's notebook, I thought, was just a really human way to do it, because a couple decades after the expedition, when he's still in St. Louis, when he's the most important diplomat with Native nations in America, he, at some point in the 1820s, sat down with this notebook and just kind of made a list of what he called the men on Lewis and Clark's trip. And he just wrote as many of them down as he could remember and wrote, were they alive or were they dead at that point? And first of all, I find that very humanizing for Clark. Like, that's a moment of nostalgia. That's getting older and kind of thinking back, what's the greatest thing I ever did? Yeah. And sort of, you know, imagining it. And so that's what he did. But it's also just, I thought it was a narrative way to kind of keep myself focused and keep readers moving through. And the list is also interesting for who's not on it. York is not on it. Clark and York had a very close relationship, even though it was one-sided and warped by, you know, the forces of slavery. But in the end, when they got back, York said, you know, I've done enough. I deserve my freedom. I did this expedition. I did as much as anybody else. I did more than a lot of the soldiers. I deserve freedom. And Clark took that personally. Clark actually made York move so he couldn't be around his wife, and their relationship really degraded. It would have gotten even worse if Lewis hadn't intervened and told Clark, you know, I don't think you should beat York. I think you should, you know, back off a little bit. But then, of course, Lewis died as well, and so things deteriorated. The epilogue's a little bleak, I guess.
Yeah.
I think the book is, you know, even when they're doing hard things, it's kind of inspiring and exciting. Right. But in the epilogue, sometimes real life doesn't end the way we want it to.
Right.
And for a lot of the people on this expedition, the expedition was such an incredible experience. But what came after was sometimes really hard. And, you know, I'm a historian, so I gotta follow the facts.
Well, I often heard of the New Madrid earthquakes. I did not realize that John Ordway's farm got flooded out because of them. So that's the human story that comes back in the book.
And it's so heartbreaking, because Ordway was a working class guy. You know, he joined the army because he didn't have other options. He just wanted to be a farmer. He spends almost 3 years seeing some of the most beautiful farmland on the continent. He comes back, he's a national hero, he buys some of that farmland, he's set up, he's got a wife, he's got kids. It seems like the rest of his life is gonna be great. He literally is the American dream.
Yeah.
And then this earthquake happens, destroys it all, he dies a couple years later. Again, that's heartbreaking, but it's what happened.
Well, Craig, thanks so much for coming on History 605, and thanks a ton for writing the book. I think readers will really get a lot out of it. Wish you all the success with the book.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thanks for sharing your perspectives and asking great questions. It's, you know, talking about Lewis and Clark, what more could we ask for?
That's right. Quite the adventure. Thanks a lot.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.